according to the schedule here, the delivered price payable in full on delivery, with no prior commitment required, and including all tooling and other overhead, is $20 million. Additional identical units on same schedule for $4 million each. That's a lot of money. My name is Long John. We call this the party line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. Monday mornings, we get started about 1. We continue through till 5:30. That means we're around for 37 and a half hours a week. Now, I imagine you're wondering what I'm talking about for $20 million. Well, I've had a few sponsors. We've sold a few things. But I don't have OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland as sponsors. But they do have something to sell. Namely, a circular foil spacecraft that is available for $20 million. We've talked about flying saucers on the program many times. And, of course, we've talked with people who claim that they've been to other planets such as Venus, Mars. We've even had a man on the program that claims that he was on the moon during groundbreaking ceremonies, the day that they started to drill the hole, you know, from the dark side to the light side of the moon. And we've had a lot of interesting offbeat people. But tonight, it appears to me that we have two very, very solid citizens who represent OTC Enterprises. And according to all of the brochures, all of the booklets, everything that we have in front of us, and believe me, we got a stack of material in front of us, plus miniature working models. Well, with all of this material, I'm led to believe that evidently these men believe that there's something to flying saucers. And the men that I'm referring to, Otis T. Carr, president, and Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering. These gentlemen are associated with OTC Enterprises. And we'll be talking with them tonight about the possibility of making a craft that can go to Venus, that can go to the moon, that can go to Mars. The cost, $20 million, and after we have the first one, well, the rest of them won't cost too much. They'll be about $4 million each. We have with us this morning Ben Iskowitz, the cybernetician, and Mel Shaloney, advertising executive. And we'll be doing a lot of talking this morning with a lot of people, and I hope that you might call some of your friends and neighbors and tell them that if they're interested in flying saucers, this is one night that they should be with us. Mr. Carr, some time ago, one of our listeners sent me a brochure that was published by OTC Enterprises. It's a very beautiful brochure. It's certainly a very inspiring one. And when I read this offer about a spacecraft that would be made available for $20 million, I nearly flipped. And I mentioned it on the air. And evidently somebody contacted your director of sales engineering, Mr. Colton, and he contacted us, and that's why you're here this morning. Before we talk about the particular spacecraft that you intend to manufacture, I would like to ask you a couple of questions. One, do you believe in the possibility of flying saucers coming to this planet, the planet Earth, from other planets?
We believe that there are unidentified, electrified objects in the air. We have seen three on three separate occasions.
When you say you've seen three, Mr. Carr, did you see them in the air? Were they hovering above a particular place?
They were going at great velocity, and they were definitely electrified because we had been working on the same principle for many years, and we recognized what we saw.
Well, when you say electrified, what other type of, if we may use the word saucers this morning, because most of our listeners understand that, what other type of saucers could there be other than electrified? Would they be gas-driven or something, sir?
There could be if we follow principles now known within our atmosphere. There are many manners in which a circular craft could be used. such as the Hiller principle and jet on the areas of the close to the foil, the leading edge. But in the instance of those which, the three different ones which we saw in 1951 and 52 were definitely electrical, and they were very close to what we had already designed.
I think you said the Hiller system?
That's right. Any system of circular rotation that can use a motive power such as jet propulsion would make an airborne craft.
In what way is your invention different from the unidentified flying objects which you have seen?
Well, we do not, naturally, not having been able to examine the objects we saw due to their great velocity, we can't say with certainty that they are similar to ours, but the principle, we feel, is the same. Our design utilizes gravity, electromagnetism, and electromotive force in a relative field to get its functional operation.
I haven't understood a single word of your last sentence. Without getting, without getting it all technical,
right,
could you sort of make it a little bit easier?
We will use this statement that we use an electrified center. It's a center power core. Now, this is what we call an accumulator. In the vernacular sense, it is a factory. It is a storage cell, an accumulation of storage cells, which provide electromotive force in the same manner that any known battery produces electromotive force.
Is that what you're holding in your hand now?
That's right. This is what we're holding.
Could you describe it to the listening audience?
This is a dimensional product. It is designed with the dimensions of space itself in mind. And we say that it is truly the geometric form of space because it is completely round and completely square. Now, in this, surfaces are all round. But when we show it this way, the surfaces are square. It has been proven in scientific laboratory that the very smallest units of matter ever photographed under an electron microscope are square in shape. This has only been found out within the past couple of months. We have known it for years and applied this principle into an electrified system. This is the center power core of our space vehicle. Now, what makes this different and unique and novel from a factory is the fact that this is a piece of moving machinery. It rotates. Our average storage battery is an inanimate object set in an inertial spot, and then the electromotive force is conducted by wires from this battery to animate some object.
Well, let me interrupt a moment, and I'll try to describe it further. Could you hand that to me, please?
Yes, indeed.
Well, it looks like two ice cream cones put together at the scoop end. But it's, the angle is a lot wider than that of the ice cream cone. There are a series of ridges. They look like places for gears to fit in. Is that correct?
No, those are, in a sense, turbine principles. They're reactor channels. And in where there is atmosphere, flow of air there aids in rotation.
Well, then this is one of the components of the drive. This is the battery.
This is the center power core.
This generates electricity?
This is right. This is a storage cell for electrical energy. In operation, it generates electricity. At the same time, it puts out electromotive force. This is the central power system for our spacecraft.
I just noticed that it opened up, and it appears to be hollowed out on the inside.
That is right.
Much, I would say, well, it's circular. The inside, when the two parts are put one on top of the other and they fit in with two pegs, the cavity inside is circular. Is there
it
any
is a
specific
sphere.
Purpose for that?
It is a sphere, yes. And each unit is a hemisphere. We call the center of this, its largest dimension, the equator. And, of course, it expands or contracts and expands to a point on each side. It's the union of two fresco-conical sections. That is what it is. Two right-angle sections. And we say that it is the dimensions of space, and we have shown how this comes about.
I'll leave the more technical aspects to Ben, whose background would fit him much better to ask these questions. I'm always good to you, Ben. There, I do see appearing in a Utica, New York newspaper dated Tuesday morning, October the 29th, 1957, an AP dispatch, a lengthy one, and there is one paragraph that says that you sent copies of your brochure outlining the system of propulsion that you have developed to President Eisenhower and members of the cabinet and the Atomic Energy Commission. Have you received an answer from them?
There was recognition of receiving the material.
Beyond that, did they give any value judgment on what you have to contribute?
No, we have not received any value judgment.
Don't you think that's a little odd?
Yes, I do.
Is there any way that you could explain it?
I have my own ideas about this. Of course, no way to substantiate such ideas. If to give my own personal opinion, we have a space vehicle that is not expendable. It does not burn up its energy in a few seconds. It carries the energy with it, and it can leave the Earth's atmosphere and return manned. It also can be used within the atmosphere, and it could make a trip from very easily as other aerial transportation systems from here to Baltimore or from here to the moon and return. Now, it is inexpensive. It certainly doesn't cost as much as the systems of one expendable rocket. The tooling is much less expensive, and whether or not our offers enter into an economic picture that is not feasible at this time, we don't know. This is one of our opinions of an answer.
Well, let me interrupt for just a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, and then we'll be back with Otis T. Carr and Norman Evans Colton of OTC Enterprises. And we're talking about a spacecraft that they are ready to produce for $20 million. In case you have that type of money, please call us immediately, and we'll all come over. I'll come over, too, to your house.
So that you, that the party line gets the opportunity, on special occasions at least, to present visual experiences of this order.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm absolutely amazed. I know that when I arrived here about 11 o'clock tonight, I saw a tremendous amount of luggage and a lot of crates and things out in the hallway here, and I didn't know what happened. I thought maybe the good white father sold the station, you know, they were moving me out of town. And when I met the two gentlemen, Mr. Carr and Mr. Colton, and they said that this was their equipment, I had no idea what they had in mind. And it's very impressive, and I also share your thoughts about this, Mel. It is rather unfortunate that we're not in a position to have picture radio tonight so they could see what's happening. But I think that possibly maybe our good friends at Fate magazine will be interested in doing something on this with some pictures or Ray Palmer in Flying Saucer magazine, or maybe our good friend Herb Bailey with Argosy may be interested in doing a story with a number of pictures. I think that this is a real story, and I think what we're doing, we're passing up too much of the story by, you know, talking between ourselves and saying what a great amount of equipment they have. I think we should get back and talk with Mr. Carr and Mr. Colton. Ben, you just don't seem to be in a happy mood.
No, I'm not.
I know. Venusian, would you care to get in this? I think you have a couple of questions.
Mr. Carr, I was wondering, I've been glancing at the literature that you provided us with, and I've been going over it. And there's a mathematical formula that crops up here that intrigues me. It's minus zero divided by plus zero equals zero. Now, the first time I ever saw a minus zero used in a mathematical equation was in the work of Pierre Quallet, who was the first mathematician ever to bring forth the idea of a minus zero, which was laughed at by most orthodox mathematicians. It also intrigues me further because the concept of minus zero is used in computers, but used in a much different way. I wonder if you could tell me more about it and exactly how you stumbled upon this idea.
This equation is brought about by the shape of our Utron electrical accumulator.
What is that again? Utron?
Utron electrical accumulator. This is the name we give for the central power core system of our spacecraft. It is dimensional, as we have said. And in our operation of working models and in checkout of experiments, we had to find the formula that fit the reasons for the actions and the reactions that we were getting. So exploring nature and studying somewhat of the inspirational work of the great Dr. Albert Einstein on relativity, we came upon this formula of linear correlations. And when we study linear correlations in geometric form, we have to have a starting point. And this is, in reality, a point. And it, from there, it expands into the cross, into the circle. And the mathematics, the only way we can express it is in the symbolism of 0x or OX. And this formula brings us to that. We claim that this is the true unified field theory in physical practice.
Well, the thing I wonder about, again, I mean, the first time I ever came across the concept of minus zero was in looking over volume 4 of Pierre Quallet's work. Hitherto before, I never saw it. And I must admit, I had never conceived of any such idea. I was wondering how you had been led to arrive at it, because previous to this, I'd always conceived and had been taught to conceive of zero as a null quantity with no sign. And when I saw the concept of minus zero in Quallet's, by the way, are you familiar with Quallet's work?
No, we are not.
But when I saw the concept of minus zero in Quallet's work, I didn't know quite what to make of it. I thought it was somehow a great idea, but somehow I didn't know how really to evaluate it. I wonder how actually you were led to arrive at this concept.
In a further study of Dr. Einstein's great inspirational work, And we corresponded with him, and we had a great good fortune to have been advised by him at one time. We learned that all measurements of time and space had to be considered in relationship to the observer. And therefore, there never was a fixed equation due to the observer being the in a sense, as I understand it, which is satisfactory to me in the application of my work, the observer himself is the somewhat the minus factor. And therefore, you cannot have any fixed
quantity of any number due to the observer. Now, in physical form, this is something else again. And we worked for a considerable time with and had many conferences with the great Nikola Tesla, and in his evaluations of the sine wave, electrical principles, wherein the true value of alternating current hydroelectric systems were developed by the great genius of this man. Further inspirations came to us. And finally, from this knowledge and from continuing to seek, we find this formula.
Did you find it, Mr. Paul?
Yes, we did.
No, I did you. I mean,
that's
did,
right.
Did a group of you work together?
No, I found it. With the assistance of Mr. Colton in evaluation. Mr. Colton researches very heavily in all the work that I do. And when we collaborate very closely. Also, Mrs. Shea collaborates with me in research.
Mr. Carr, when was OTC incorporated? What year, sir?
1955.
And how long prior to the year of 1955 were you associated with Mrs. Shea and Mr. Colton?
Not before that. They've come with me since.
And prior to that time then, prior to 1955, were you interested in this?
We started this development in 1937. Our investigations begun in 1937. We were actively making models in 1938 to 1942. We've come up with basic principles.
In other words, 18 years prior to this year, you had an idea in your mind, Mr. Carr, that possibly some type of craft could be developed that you could get into space with it. Is that right?
This is true. Mm-hmm.
Do you hope that this craft, if you are able to manufacture it, do you hope that you could go to any other planet with it?
We know we could.
You know you could.
We know.
What planet, for instance, do you think it would be capable of reaching?
Escaping from the immediate gravity pull of the Earth, plus the heavy atmosphere of the Earth, enables us, just as our satellites are doing now, Flores and Rush and Sputnik, to join a universal free energy system. They have a velocity now of 18,000 miles per hour, more or less, without the expenditure of any energy whatsoever. Now, any energy attached to these would immediately throw them into a higher velocity orbit, which would expand them farther into space. This is extremely easy to do. We feel that our craft will gradually escape and comfortably escape from the atmosphere of the Earth, and then we can handle velocities almost unimaginable in reaching other gravity systems. And the moon should not be more than 5 hours away.
5 hours away from Baltimore, Maryland.
That's right. That is right.
How many people can you take in this craft if you are able to?
The one that we have on our design board is 45 foot in diameter, and the cabin will accommodate three in total comfort. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
And what type of equipment do you hope to have on this spacecraft?
On this craft, insofar as the individual's concerned, they can travel the same as on a pressurized airliner or in a submarine. We don't have the problem of G-suits that are brought about by high velocities. We don't have the problem of thermal barriers, which are spoken about because the electromagnetic system sets up a protective shield in our craft, which enables us to overcome these barriers without any discomfort to the occupants who are passengers and operators of the craft. And we can very slowly rise from the earth. And we can, once we are outside this atmosphere, accelerate the tremendous velocity. Well, with perfection in certain systems between planets, up to near the velocity of light itself.
Mr. Carr, I'm interested in this, very much so. In fact, we had something else planned for this morning for our discussion. And when we received the telegram about 1 or 2 o'clock yesterday morning from Mr. Colton, we immediately contacted you, and I'm very grateful that Mr. Colton was kind enough to arrange your appearance this morning. I am greatly interested, though, in the method of landing this craft if you were able to get to the moon. Well, let us forget about going to the moon a moment. If you take this craft up from this planet, from your airport in Baltimore, how does it land, sir?
Back in Baltimore?
Yes.
Very simply, we can rise at the very slow velocity of 100 feet a minute or less, and we can sit down as gently as a feather because we have joined. Part of the operation of our craft is joining the universal system. This is a relative velocity craft, and the minute it reaches the relative velocity of its attractive inertial mass, it becomes weightless as regards this inertial attraction. It does, individually, it is not weightless. It has the same weight as before. But when it reaches a relative rotation, it becomes an independent system, just as a planet is an independent system.
Is there any gravitational pull at this point, sir?
None whatsoever.
What happens to the occupants of the spacecraft if there's gravitational pull?
They are perfectly comfortable inside the craft.
Well, I mean, are their heads on the ceiling, or
not at all?
Lying on the wall, or what?
Not at all. They will have the same feeling of pressure of weight that they have right now, because we will maintain as near as possible the atmospheric pressure of the Earth at sea level with inside the cabin.
Well, this is very technical for me, Mr. Carr, so please accept my apologies for being rather stupid and ignorant in my line of questioning this morning. I am under the impression that the only reason I am able to sit in this chair at the present time and remain in this position is because of gravitational pull. Am I correct in assuming that?
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial.
Now, we have this at around 14 pounds per square inch within our atmosphere.
So when you say we have this, what are you referring to, sir?
Well, I mean right here.
You mean
now,
like in this room?
That's
in this
right.
Studio, yes.
So, men have been able to be sealed off away from such a condition, and then artificially this atmospheric pressure, such as pressurizing the cabin, is maintained. We have it very well in submarines. The system technically that is used in a submarine is all that is necessary to be used in our craft.
In other words, undersea, where a submarine may be, there is no gravitational pull. Is that what you're saying?
There is gravitational pull at all times, yes. But we're speaking about the atmosphere of the particular occupants inside a sealed unit.
Well, is that necessary to keep the occupants in the position that they desire?
This is
the atmospheric condition?
Absolutely, because in a vacuum, they are at the mercy of any velocity.
What would happen, sir, if you had some type of instrument that you could turn on at the present time to eliminate the gravitational pull that we assume is in this room? What would happen to me, sir?
Well, you would, in a sense, become very buoyant.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not in itself, it may be a novelty, but it certainly does not have any disastrous effects on people.
Would I still remain in this position?
You could, but any movement could very quickly move you out of that position.
Would our pads of papers and pencils and the picture and thing and the mics remain in this position?
Until they were brought into any movement. Then any movement would immediately make them buoyant themselves.
Well, then let me ask you this, sir. I have an ordinary lead pencil in my hand now.
If I hold this up in the air and if I release the pressure of my fingers from the body of this pencil, the pencil will automatically fall to the table because of the gravitational pull, right?
This is true.
If we had this other condition that you so aptly described a moment ago, if I released my fingers from the body of this pencil, would the pencil remain in midair?
This is true. It would stay there.
I believe what you're saying, Mr. Carr, is that you would be creating an artificial gravitational system within the body of the spacecraft, and yet there would not be any gravity on the outside.
Exactly correct.
And this is done by, as I've been reading your material, this is done by the battery, which I've attempted to describe, spinning around, creating its own gravitational influence?
This is the beginning of an answer to the solution. We have capacitor plates and electromagnets as a part of this system. Now, this is counter-rotating. The electromagnets rotate in one direction, and the accumulator, the battery, rotates in another. The capacitor plates rotate in conjunction with the battery so that we have a clockwise and a counterclockwise rotation. Now, the third system is the cabin that maintains the crew. This does not rotate. It is fixed due to the fact that the two bodies are rotating clockwise and counterclockwise as the situation as a cabin. Therefore, the system that causes the craft to become escape from the gravity pull, the craft itself, due to this system, still has internally gravity because it still has the same weight that it had in the beginning. It hasn't lost any weight.
What charges this battery?
This starts out electrochemically, the same as other batteries, but we do have a regenerative system that is very unique. We are able here, for the first time to our knowledge, to use atmospheric electricity as a recharging system. This is done as a part of the operational principle of the craft. Now, the capacitor plates...
Wait a minute. You say you use atmospheric electricity.
That's right.
What happens when you leave the atmosphere and there isn't any atmosphere?
We have the electrochemical system then to provide us with all the energy that we need. And we have a regenerating system in a matter of regenerative coil that recharge this battery in the same manner in which your storage battery in your automobile is recharged now by a generator.
If I understand the implications of what you're saying, it would appear to me, and I must confess almost complete ignorance in this field, that what you have done is made the first perpetual motion machine.
There's nothing perpetual about our machine. The energies that cause it to operate are perpetual. You cannot destroy matter. You cannot destroy energy. Molecular flow is perpetual and has been proven. In the laboratory, they have proven that electricity itself is immortal. When we take away resistance, you can set up a spark of electricity and it will continue to operate. Therefore, we have perpetual energies. No machine that we can conceive of made by man would be perpetual. But it is free energy. It is self-energizing. And as long as all parts function and do not wear out, this is truly a self-energizing machine.
Well, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. I certainly again repeat the statement that was just made by Mel Shaloney, that it is very unfortunate that we are not in a position to show you some of the models that we have here this morning. And I will try, and I know that Ben Iskowitz and Mel Shaloney will also try to describe some of these models. In other words, we have them right here this morning. We're talking this morning with Otis T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland,
and Norman Evans Colton, Director of Sales Engineering. My other guest this morning, Ben Iskowitz, the cybernetician, and we have Mel Shaloney, advertising executive, with us. We have talked many, many times on these mics, across these mics, with many people who claim they've been to Venus and to a lot of other places. And a lot of people have told us about flying saucers arriving here from other planets. I can only tell you this, that this morning we have actual models of what Mr. Carr described as spacecraft that he claims can reach the moon in 5 hours. And, would you like to have one? Because on this deal, the delivered price, payable in full on delivery, with no prior commitment required, and including all tooling and other overhead, $20 million. And when you own one of those, 5 hours from the time that it's delivered to you in Baltimore, Maryland, you'll be up on the moon. And in case you go there, don't forget, send me a postcard, please. Nelson. Or Ben Iskowitz, I'm sorry.
Mr. Carr, I've been going over this again, and I'm intrigued by the mathematics of it. I don't quite understand it. I don't know whether in deriving these formulas you are using the methods of conventional algebraic methods. But you have here one expression, minus x divided by plus x equals x. Now, I would normally say that minus x divided by plus x equals minus 1, because according to algebraic conventions, any number divided by itself equals 1. And any time you go through a division with unequal signs, the quotient is a minus value. Now, were you using conventional algebraic methods?
No, we weren't. Partly conventional. But we were joining actual space form and dimension, which is, as seen there, geometry, along with algebra, to arrive at a satisfactory equation for ourselves, which can be demonstrated in the physical form. We do not pose as a complete mathematician, but this has been the satisfactory formula which has brought functional application.
But aren't the physical laws that upon which your invention work, aren't they expressible in mathematical terms?
Possibly. But I wouldn't say that I'm qualified. I am very satisfied with this formula.
Well, it puzzles me. It's like saying that minus 4 divided by plus 4 equals 4.
Sometimes these solutions are not always what they appear, as we know in one instance that 1 plus 1 can equal 3.
1 plus 1 can equal 3?
That's true.
When?
Well, because two conditions always produce a third.
That's right. The third condition is 2, isn't it?
Not necessarily. It's another sum.
Could you go over some of the conditions when this would produce in 3?
Well, if one condition operates one way, another condition operates another way, and when they're joined, then you have another condition, the sum is 3.
Well, that's a little bit over my head. I've been looking at this prototype you have here, and I noticed that within a small wooden frame or scaffolding, you have a larger model of the double cone that we have here on the table. And around it is a wooden ring, and there seem to be coils of wire with what looks to me to be the electromagnets. Now, is that what they are?
That's right. This is a wood mock-up of a functional operational model. Incidentally, this model has been built, has been activated, and it has checked out.
What we have here is a simple
section is the cones. That is our Yukon electrical accumulator. That is the power system. This system activates these electromagnets. And in turn, activates...
But the system, the thing inside, activates the electromagnets on the outside?
This is true, yes. Now, we do this by contacting this lead wires from the positive and negative poles of this battery to the electromagnets, and then we have circuit breakers from these electromagnets, and we have counter rotation. This electromagnets will rotate, in this instance, counterclockwise, while the internal area is rotating clockwise.
Well, are the coils of wire on the model itself, are they magnetized also?
Oh, the coils of wire...
I mean, inside the ring.
Well, now these, inside the ring, these coils are regenerative coils. They are electromotive force coils. And they assist in regenerating the battery because they are loops of wire conducted, brought through a magnetic field which sets up an electromotive force. These others are capacitor plates, and these are also activated by the central power core. But these capacitor plates, which can accept the very high charge through mutual conductance, also, through the process of ionization, utilize atmospheric electricity.
Well, the fact that you're putting capacitor plates on the outside flanges of the thing, doesn't this ruin the fact that you have two cones superimposed on their meeting at their bases?
No.
So that you have something that is also square? I mean, if you turn that thing, and you've tilted that thing, which I can do with this smaller model, I can get a square, but I don't see how you tilt with that.
Well, dimensionally it is. It is square in these dimensions. And when this rotation starts and builds up to a certain velocity, this form is very important because we have the total equation of action and reaction. Now, this is done by a system of coil winding wherein we start at a point and wind, expand to an equator. And from the equator, we continue our winding down to a point. This is physical expansion and contraction in electromagnetic field. The gravity enters the picture in the form of this relative rotation. When the relative rotation of any inertial attractive mass is a matter of dimension, so that the Earth, if we say that it is 8,000 miles in diameter, we know its fixed rotation is 1 in 24. If it were 1 mile in diameter, its rotation would be 8,000 in 24. And by the same system, our 45-foot craft will have a relative rotation of about 580 RPMs a minute. And in this, when it reaches this rotation, it is totally independent of its inertial attractive mass in an electromagnetic field.
580 RPMs a minute? That's not very fast, is it?
Well, if you saw a merry-go-round going 580 RPMs a minute, that would be quite fast.
Well,
this is relevant.
What about these, I think it's quite within my capacity to take these small models you have here, and to spin it at 500 or even more, 580 RPMs a minute, will they take off?
This model was spun at 40,000 RPMs a minute.
Continue.
And when it did, it set up a pressure pattern equivalent to 1,000 tons. It exploded. The horsepower rating was around a little over 700. Six engineers checked this out. Now, the relative rotation of this model would be about 58,000 RPMs a minute.
And when it reached that rotation, it would immediately take off.
Well, Mr. Carr, I'm sorry to interrupt at this time, but we're going to have to take care of a little business.
Otis T. Carr, president, and Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering. I might also add that Sam Vandivert, the photographer who took all of the pictures that are appearing in the current edition of Argosy magazine dated April, the story about the party line with photographs of many of the people that we've had on the party line. Sam is here with us this morning, and he's taking some pictures of the various models that Mr. Carr and Mr. Colton brought with them from Baltimore. And no doubt these pictures will be seen in some national publication in the near future, at which time I will certainly call it to your attention. We're talking about the OTCX-1 circular foil spacecraft. This is a craft described by Mr. Carr, and he tells us that when it is completed, you can go to the moon in just 5 hours. Of course, my next question automatically would be, who wants to go to the moon? But I guess there's possibly something there that would be of interest to somebody. And we'll sort of start this segment with this telegram from Gloria Charles of New York. Dear Long John, please ask Otis Carr this. Would the time factor be involved with his craft? Sincerely, Gloria Charles.
In our system, in the solar system, the time factor would be involved, yes, within our own system. We evaluate time on the velocity of light, and in certain systems, if we exceed the velocity of light, unquestionably time would slow up. Just as it's also...
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Carr. Your craft can exceed the velocity of light?
We don't say this. We say in other systems.
I thought nothing could be. I thought that was a constant factor in the universe.
Not necessarily. We do not believe it, so.
Well, this is one of Einstein's constants.
We don't believe that it is totally constant. Possibly in our system. In our solar system, it's not necessarily true in other systems.
Einstein's rule was that in all systems, the speed of light is the limiting velocity in the universe. If anything approaches the speed of light, it becomes pure energy.
Pure energy. But in other systems, it could change.
Well, what other systems?
Other solar systems. We are completely controlled by our own system and our own sun. And unquestionably, the velocity of light here is our yardstick and our pattern. Our craft is designed around it.
Are you speechless at the moment, sir?
No. Yeah, I am going to go home and take the books off the shelf and throw them out, because I can't conceive of it. I mean,
isn't it possible, then, as time goes along, don't you find that every day you learn something that possibly yesterday you were not familiar with?
That is true in some cases, but, John, but you just don't suddenly upset one of the basic fundamentals of the universe, namely that the speed of light is a constant in the universe beyond which nothing can exceed its velocity.
Ben, I'm glad that you're more or less speechless at the moment, because it gives me an opportunity...
You better get away from me, because it might be catching.
It gives me an opportunity to get in a word edgewise, which has been rather difficult up until now.
I want everyone to know that Dave Bell and I are really friends.
Yes. Ben, how are you able to make statements about the speed of light in other solar systems?
I'm not making statements about the speed of light. I'm making statements about Einstein's theory of relativity, which states that he takes as a fundamental axiom that the speed of light is constant in all systems.
Doesn't Mr. Einstein say it is
Dr.
a relative... Dr. Einstein, I'm sorry. Doesn't he say that any measurement is relative to other measurements?
That's quite true, except this one.
Except this one.
That's the first axiom. In fact, that's the first axiom upon that, and another axiom is the whole basis upon which the theory of relativity is based upon. And I mean, you've read it, haven't you, Dave?
Yes, I have. Ben, what is an axiom?
An axiom is a self-evident truth.
This is assumed.
You know, the things you come out with on the program occasionally.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you very much, Ben. Dr. Einstein was assuming that this constancy of the speed of light for the self-evident truth. Isn't this correct?
He wasn't assuming it. You don't assume it. In fact, one of his quotations was that I take this as the fundamental rock upon which I build the entire theory.
Ben,
this is not an assumption. It's kind of strong to be an assumption.
Does the speed of light depend to any extent on the density of the medium through which it's passing?
No.
It doesn't. Can you explain refraction?
That's something entirely different.
It has nothing to do with light?
It has nothing to do with the speed of light. It has to do with the direction of light.
Then why is it that a light beam is bent when it passes at an angle other than 90 degrees from a medium of one density into a medium of another density?
It's being bent. It's not being slowed down.
How is it bent?
My specialty was not optics. It is being bent. It is not being slowed down. Now, I will refer you to a simple little experiment conducted by two men called Michelson and Morley. The speed of light is constant. The medium through which it travels has nothing to do with its speed, namely the atmosphere of the Earth, the emptiness of space, or anything else.
Messrs. Michelson and Morley had...
Doctors
Michelson and Morley had very little opportunity to test out their theory in the emptiness of space, did they?
Why didn't they? Light travels through the emptiness of space.
The experiment was done by means of some rotating discs with slits in them.
Flashlights, too.
Yes, well, the Michelson-Morley experiment was
Since been done with light from the sun. The Michelson-Morley experiment has been duplicated countless of times with light from the sun, which I assume travels through empty space.
Unless you still believe
in the universal ether theory.
But without one of the disks being located at the sun, both of the disks were located on the Earth.
That's right. Both of the disks were located on the sun and the original, on the Earth in the original Michelson-Morley experiment. Since then, the Michelson-Morley experiment has been repeated. Using the light from the sun.
Well, if I may interrupt a moment, Dave, statement that was made by our guest, Mr. Carr, I was just wondering, do you disagree with the possibility of it?
Well, John, I have no way of really determining what happens to an object when it approaches or exceeds the speed of light. I do know that Einstein's theory of relativity says that the mass increases as it approaches the speed of light. The longitudinal dimension decreases, approaching zero, and that when it has approached the speed of light, that it becomes pure energy. Now,
you disagree then with the theory that Mr. Carr has expounded here this morning for the principle of this spacecraft.
Well, John, I don't think that I'm able to, because I couldn't even agree or disagree with Dr. Einstein. I'm a little too stupid.
I'd like to put a word in at this point.
Mr. Colton, please.
As for a definition, I think in talking about the speed of light and thinking of that speed in terms of 186,000 miles a second, we're getting a little bit mixed up with the wave velocity of light. And remember that the equation is speed of light squared, which in my poor mathematics would be something around 3 trillion miles a second.
No, that's not it at all.
You disagree, Ben?
No.
Light is traveling at a forward velocity in a wave motion, and so that the total velocity is far in excess of 186,000 miles a second.
No, you are perhaps thinking of the famous formula E equals mc squared, which is not a measurement of the speed of light. It's the expression of how much energy is released by matter being changed into energy. The energy resulting from a certain measurement of matter, the energy that resulting from this unit of matter is times the matter times the square of the speed of light, which is 186,000 miles
Well, I'm glad I qualified my mathematics because I think we do accept that the light traveling in a forward direction or in a straight line direction is traveling in a wave motion. So that if it's forward direction...
Well, I mean, I don't know whether it is. I mean, I can introduce you to 20 physicists who say waves and others will say photons, and I can even get three or four who say it travels in wavicles.
May I...
Mr. Carr, please.
Intercede here to state that Professor Pickard has the famous stratosphere balloonist, has often evaluated the slowing up of time. And his comparison of this is that a space voyager could, in a relatively short time for himself, travel into galaxies far beyond our own, providing his craft had such velocities to so do. And then return to his point of beginning, in this instance, if we say it were the planet Earth, and find that 2,000 years had elapsed, and not even any of his progeny or children or so forth were even surviving. Now, this is thinking men who have come up with these evaluations. We don't suppose here...
This is quite true. It's part of Einstein's theory.
This definitely, in my mind, changes the velocity pictures. And this, if you change time, you must change the velocity of light.
Well, if you accept Einstein's dictum that time slows down as as a system approaches the speed of light, and that's exactly what he said, approaches the speed of light, which has been experimentally proven in the Bell Telephone laboratories, that when particles approach the speed of light, time does slow down. Now, this is quite true. If you accept that part of Einstein's theory, I mean, I don't understand why you don't accept the original hypothesis upon which the entire structure was built, namely that the speed of light is a constant in all systems.
Maybe we're a little radical in our thinking. However, we must get back to what has been accomplished. We have invented an electrified system which makes it possible for a propulsion system that we put into operation to carry human beings with a fuel system that is not expendable and take them into space and bring them back in return. And this craft could, if I had the tools now, and those tools are available in large plants, and if one was available to me, we could have this craft on the moon within 6 months from this date.
Mr. Carr, on this sheet that I have in front of me, the sheet that is headed with these words, performance characteristic and delivery terms for the OTCX-1 circular coil spacecraft, I notice in the paragraph headed physical component, that you mentioned in here, safety under normal conditions to be anticipated in flight to be to within 1,000 miles away from Earth. Now, maybe I'm not reading this correctly, sir, but the way I read this, I am assuming that at the present time you feel that the OTCX-1 craft could go a distance of 1,000 miles away from Earth. And yet, just a few minutes ago, you told us that you could go to the moon in 5 hours.
This is true. The same craft. This, after all, this was a contract form, and we have not been to the moon. We're going to enjoy looking at the Earth 1,000 miles out. And I think this would be satisfactory if we made a safe return.
From a distance of 1,000 miles.
That's right.
And the 1,000-mile figure was picked as an arbitrary figure for demonstration purposes only. That before we delivered the craft, we would give it a shakedown cruise and take it approximately 1,000 miles out. From
before you deliver it to the purchaser.
That's right.
Then let me ask you this, Mr. Colton. How long would it take you to go 1,000 miles away from the Earth and return, providing that you don't hover around some 1,000 miles away from the Earth?
Well, it could be done in a matter of minutes. It would probably, because of the takeoff and landing practicalities, would
could be done comfortably in the space of an hour.
An hour?
1 hour.
It could be done comfortably.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
To avoid awkward velocities, any discomfort to the...
Well, then, in other words, the possibility of going to the moon in 5 hours is a dream at the moment, right?
No, I wouldn't say it's a dream.
Well, if it takes you an hour to go out 1,000 miles, to go 1,000 miles from the Earth and return, if it takes you an hour, it should take you a little longer than five to go to the moon, unless you've got a, you know, an indirect route that will save you a little time.
You think of it in terms of a passenger train leaving the station and arriving at another station, or an aircraft in its travel between cities. The disproportionate amount of time it takes in the takeoff and approach and landing. Distance of approximately 60 miles in the heavy atmosphere would be negotiated rather slowly, relatively slowly. Mm-hmm. Once out of that atmosphere, as Mr. Carr said, almost any speed is hypothetically possible, mm-hmm. up to approaching the speed of light. You wouldn't approach any such speed because you would have accomplished your 1,000 miles in the wink of an eye. That's why I say that these figures are just rounded off and are selected arbitrarily for discussion and for preparing these contract proposals.
Mr. Colton, $20 million sounds like a lot of money. That is, if you were intending to buy a pound of jelly beans with it. It would be a classical amount of money. But $20 million doesn't sound like a lot of money to me if you could produce the craft that you have described this morning and the craft that's described in the various brochures that you've given us. Do you have any idea in your mind why some of our big aeronautical concerns, Fairchild, Lockheed, I don't know the names of all of them, but there are certainly numerous ones, why is it that they haven't taken advantage of this opportunity to invest some $20 million? And it's quite possible that it wouldn't cost them $20 million if they have some of the equipment, as Mr. Carr has suggested. There are some tools that are available in other plants.
Up to the present time, perhaps the total and very simple answer is that we haven't approached them directly with an offer to fabricate craft for them. We haven't offered to sell them anything yet.
Well, you were incorporated in 55, right, sir?
Yes, sir.
And I imagine that you have made some efforts to get some money to be able to build your plant?
Yes, our only formal proposals to construct these craft up to the present time have all been directed to government agencies.
In other words, this particular sheet that I have in front of me with this offer, such as the performance factor, the physical component, and the delivered price and the delivery and so on, this is offered only to the government?
Up to this time, it has been offered only to the government.
When you say up to this time, do you mean up to the year 58?
Yes.
Is there any reason why the offer was limited to only the government?
I would sum it all up and use the word patriotic. It was offered only to the government up to the present time because we felt that the first opportunity for the use of these craft should be given to the government, to its various agencies. And I don't mean to limit that to military agencies. Offers were made to the Secretary of Commerce and to the Secretary of Interior, and they would be freely projected to any of the other official agencies that might have use for these craft or for these propulsion systems or the energy systems.
Is that what you're selling, a propulsion system, an energy system, or are you selling a spacecraft?
Well, we've been talking about spacecraft exclusively tonight so far, but this same power package, which will energize and propel a circular foil spacecraft, can also produce electric current or mechanical motion through gears and pulleys and conventional motion arrangements.
Do you think that the government would frown on any
private group raising $20 million to build a craft that they could go to the moon? Or do you think our government would want to have some control over it, that they would have the first rights to, or the at least the rights to decide who the occupants would be of the spacecraft?
No, I don't think that anyone would want to be restrictive of what we have characterized in our published advertisements as peaceful atomic energy and a new electrical age. The system that you see here in mock-up prototype is capable of energizing almost any device that today is energized by some other system or using some fuel other than the electromagnetic energies that we call space forces, the forces of gravity and magnetism.
Mr. Colton, you just made a remark a couple of minutes ago that you have never offered this plan, this proposition to any aeronautical companies, right?
That is correct. Mm. Not in a formal manner.
In a formal manner. I would assume, though, that almost all of the large aircraft companies must be aware of OTC. The fact that I do a little bit for 5.5 hours on radio at night, and if I'm aware of OTC Enterprises, I imagine that some of the men over at Fairchild and Lockheed and Wright and places like that must have heard of OTC Enterprises.
Well, I would say, frankly, that I know that some have, and when I use terms like formally and officially, I'm not trying to be devious. It's that our visits from aircraft people so far have been informal and exploratory visits from employees who spoke only for themselves. We've had a lot of mail from employees of aircraft manufacturing companies.
But not from the principals?
Not from the principals.
Isn't that a little shocking, sir?
Well, I prefer not to characterize it. I don't know what the reason might be, really.
Do you think that we're being kidded by our government, or do you really believe that the government is interested in getting to the moon? And if you've got a piece of equipment here that can be manufactured for a small amount of money, like $20 million, which is a drop in the bucket in my book, and that you can go to the moon in 5 hours, what are they playing for down at Cape Canaveral? What's all this time being wasted? I mean, if you really have it, Mr. Colton. I don't know. In other words, I see a mock-up here, and it's an interesting gadget, to say the least, and I've seen your brochures, and they're very attractive. They're mouth-watering, to say the least.
I agree with you, and my answer to that would be only opinion and would be purely conjectural. I can tell you that we have, in conjunction with the specification sheet that you've been reading from, with an opening and closing paragraph, made it clear, and also in conversations with the principals of some of these agencies, made it clear that if they will write out an order to take delivery of a satisfactorily demonstrated full-scale craft at a COD price of $20 million, before we attempt to perform on that order, or before we even pick up the order, we will manufacture and demonstrate a miniature prototype model of, say, 10-foot diameter to prove that our statements are correct and that we can do what we say we will do.
My guest this morning, Otis T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland, and Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering of OTC Enterprises. Ben Iskowitz is with us, Dave Bell, Mel Shaloney, and I had another mic set up. Believe me, I mentioned earlier, I said 9 chances out of 10, when Roy is finished with his last performance, he probably will want. You want to join for a moment, Roy? Grab a seat. While Roy Benson, the boy comic, is joining us, want to put this... want to connect that for me there, please? Thank you. Roy Benson is with us. Stopped over after playing a little club date in Max's Busy Bee.
Or been working one of the better stuff?
No, it's a telecast.
through the telephone.
Oh, yes?
Yes. Jack Parshall.
Oh, we on it?
Yeah.
I thought I was kidding you for a moment. I didn't know you were over there on this part.
I thought you
were during the week.
Well, I had to pitch some Svengali's on 40th Street. It's a very interesting looking model here, you know? Isn't it a fascinating thing?
When do we take off? Well, now, this thing, you know, will take you right to the moon. Not this one. I mean, this is a mock-up. It will take you to the moon in 5 hours. I'd like to just give you a few facts about this, the performance factor. OTC Enterprises Incorporated will demonstrate that the OTCX1 craft will depart from any specified location in the continental United States, orbit one or more times outside the Earth's atmosphere, and land its crew safely within the inner rotunda courtyard of the Pentagon building in Washington or at any other location best suited to public observation.
Very nice, this thing. What are these coils around the edge? I noticed some wound coils.
Tell you what, Roy, would you care to take a moment to describe to our listeners? Wait a minute, let me find out one. Al, is he on mic all right? Roy, fine.
Well,
You want to describe this?
I'll do the best I can. Now, this is, to describe this thing as best I can, imagine, if you will, a circle about, 16, 17, 18 inches in diameter. Two circles that sort of form, sort of a colonnade. In other words, one circle thing over another circle thing. And then, from the top of the circle and coming down from the bottom of the circle are two cones. In other words, one is up like a
round pyramid
and the other one's like an inverted round pyramid. There are a number of what appear to be copper wound coils around the edge of it. If you looked at it head on, it would look like an old-fashioned airplane engine, more or less. And then there's sort of a framework on the top, and underneath there are sort of braces. I can't find the tweeter on it, but that's about the general idea. And, oh, I noticed this, these cones that are placed mouth-to-mouth with some coils and what appear to be on the edge, the coils are on the edge of the thing, it revolves within this structure. That's the only way I can describe it. It's a tough thing to describe, actually, I think. And if I had BCA training, I could probably do much better.
That's my problem, too. I haven't got BCA training. Well, now, what is this one, Mr. Colton, that you have over here?
Well, this is a paper mock-up to show the counter-rotation principle. And this outside circular section is the section that Roy is describing, looking at the other exposed mock-up, which contains the electrified horseshoe magnets. And this would rotate in one direction counterclockwise, while the center section with the Utron electrical accumulator, which he has described as the two inverted cones mouth-to-mouth, would rotate clockwise in the other direction.
But in other words, would these coils be in this part of this?
In the outer ring.
In the outer ring.
Counterclockwise. That's correct.
What is this material that is used in the construction of it? I don't mean the mock-up, but in the actual spacecraft.
A number of materials would be used.
No, I mean, would this be aluminum, say?
Possibly aluminum, possibly fiberglass. Certainly not any materials or metals or products that are not known to us as conventional products and easily available for conventional manufacturers.
Mr. Kilburn, at what speed would this have to rotate in the on the planet in order to overcome the
I'm glad you asked that because in discussing the subject of space and spacecraft and space flight, we have been conditioned to regard it as dealing with space outside of the Earth's atmosphere. And, of course, the craft that OTC Enterprises will manufacture are highly functional in the atmosphere and can take crew and passengers and supplies and equipment as easily from New York to Washington as from New York to the moon. In proximity to the Earth, which we discuss as being in fact with gravitation and mass, because we could also be discussing proximity to the moon, where the rotation would be relatively distant for similar speed functions. In proximity to the Earth, our stress, as specified in the sheet John's been reading from, which would be about a 45-foot diameter stress, would have a threshold rotational speed to relatively equal the Earth's rotational speed of about 580 revolutions a minute.
This is 710 on the dial, WOR Radio, New York City.
As you described it, vernacular gives this course relative weightlessness.
When you say 580 RPM, do you mean that the outer ring is rotating in one direction, 580 RPM, and the inner cone is rotating in the other direction at the same speed, giving a total rotation of one relative to the other of 1160?
You have it exactly. Although I don't know that the 1160 has any bearing on the matter.
Well, it would be twice the rotation of reference to the Earth.
What we're achieving here is we're not shooting for a certain rotation for the sake of rotation, but for the sake of relativity to the attractive mass. The Earth at 8,000 miles diameter, rotating once in 24 hours, is relatively equal to a 25-foot cross rotating at 580. And for a better idea for the listeners as to what would be analogous to this 580, we calculated to be the approximate rotational speed of an automobile tire on a car moving at about 25 to 30 miles an hour, depending on the diameter of the tire.
There was a thought that occurred to me to make a basic description of this device. This machine, as seen from the outside, I was attempting to describe the inside of the mechanism, which was very difficult, but I think I could describe it this way, if I may, to the audience. Imagine taking a couple of loudspeaker cones and putting them mouth to mouth. Now, that seems to be the body of the craft as you would see it in flight or, well, let's say landing. Now, around this is an independent ring running through. From the top to the bottom is an axis, and the axis is braced through the ring, so that these two mouth-to-mouth speaker cones revolve inside the ring and on its axis. Am I correct or fairly correct in that description? Just to give them a picture.
A very good picture.
Just a rough idea.
In its totality, of course, it looks like what is commonly described as a flying saucer.
Yes. Sort of in a way, it's like a flying saucer. It sort of reminds me of a gyroscope.
That is a good analogy, too. This craft, among other things, has tremendous structural stability because all of its motion is around its own central axis, so that it would be completely vibrationless, and it would not have the stresses and strains of other types of moving vehicles that we're acquainted with.
Well, I missed, unfortunately, part of the show. Have you described the basic principle of the thing?
Yes, Mr. Carr described the basic principle and the relationships of electricity and electromagnetism and electromotive force and mechanical motion as they are employed in the assembly of units that you were describing in the other wooden mock-up.
Well, could a small craft be made to take off at least? In other words, could this thing be made at this time on a small scale and made to take off as an experiment?
Mr. Carr has estimated that.
Please, sir. We plan to build a prototype model as a demonstration device. Now, I would like to state that six operational models have been built by me and tested. Each one became airborne. One was lost entirely to the state. We had the control system, and this one didn't function.
Mm-hmm.
This has already been done.
I see. You know, years ago, a man showed me just two cross pieces. This is no relation to Homer or Boomer. There were two pieces of balsam wood curved slightly upwards. He used to steam them. Steam these two, and just like an F shape, and connected with an ordinary rubber band, and he would steam them. Now, this is when I was a kid. You know how long ago that was. And as he would steam it, this thing would take off and go very nicely, and then just gently descend to the ground. And so it's not surprising to me that a thing like this is quite feasible. As a matter of fact, look at the fantastic flying platform. I think the Navy had something to do with it.
But you just described the principle that he was coming
in. Yeah. Well, he said that someday this is going to be an important way of flying instead of the prop in the front. He was right about the helicopter. Okay. Now, the platform, how does that work? And perhaps you've been kind enough to tell us, if you will, how does it differ from this particular flying saucer? That's what it really is. In principle, in other words, in motivation.
The flying platform, I believe that that's the combination of a propeller and a jet. Both directing an airstream downward. This doesn't have an airfoil that I've been able to find.
None whatsoever.
I just calculated that the speed of the circumference is 1,363 miles per hour. And what kind of norm is that, isn't it? From the atmosphere?
No, it won't, because it has its own protective shield which gives its electromagnetic activation. This we describe the master sense, such as it's a self-contained unit, same as an orange, contains the juice of any skin, and we maintain our own circulatory system, mammals and animals and so forth. In the same sense, this ionization of these capacitor plates sets up a glow. And incidentally, this craft will glow very brilliantly with a very soft luminescent light.
What color?
It would be in the nature of blue-green or very similar to the electric arc.
Sort of a cold. I know what they are. I think I know.
And this is the shield of protection, so that we do not have a heat barrier here in forward velocity at all. Now, this electromagnetic shield is being tested out now in conventional aircraft, including very effective. But we have known that this functions for a long time in our particular operation. We found it out by physical, actual test.
Hmm. Have you patented this?
We have patent applications in preparation and on file.
I see. I mean, I personally, this is only one man's opinion, I'm very reluctant to try to argue with you about this device or take umbrage or anything like that because of the fact that this looks like a very definite look into the future. And I'm inclined to call it a flying saucer. And at the same time, personally, I'm reluctant to lend credence to the contact stories that I have heard. I'm afraid to say I just don't seem to take them too seriously. I can't. They don't seem to have much substance. Do you think that there are flying saucers from other planets?
There are electrified, unidentified, to me unidentified, flying objects. We have seen three, as we mentioned earlier on this program. And we were interested, and we felt that we were a very good observer, inasmuch as we had already been building models and testing them out, electrical systems. The first, by the time that we had seen these first observations. Now, it's not up to me to conjecture whether or not they are from other planets, but the evidence so points, because we certainly wouldn't appropriate $365 million to build one rocket, the patient, if we had such a system, which we propose to make possible. We have a system ourselves to make possible here, but if the system is already in operation, then surely something is very wrong that all this money is spent on expendable rockets, 55 $1 million is no cost at all to test out a rocket that may not get 2 feet off the ground.
So what do you think about the principle of, let's say, suppose there were certain things about this that did not turn out right under practical conditions? Is it possible to, let's say, rocketize the edges of these cones and have the thing spin by rocket propulsion?
We don't need it. We have a tremendous spin here. The electric motor operates identically the same way. You set up an electromotive force inside a magnetic field, and you immediately get rotation. So we actually have here an improved electrical motor, which in itself is a circular device. And we say that we have really put the wheel in the air in another dimension.
Yes. We might be living through sort of a fantastic revelation in that we don't know. Maybe certain governments are actually experimenting in half-foot craft in the air, and we could sit here at this panel and talk about it quite idly. And to those in the know that are actually making similar devices, they're maybe a little bit upset about the matter, and there's nothing much they can do about it, apparently. I remember well, prior to World War I, there was one article in Congress. It was called U-235, I believe, and it was an explanation of the uranium atom. Now, during the war, one article written in good faith, nobody plotted anything or anything like that. There was an article called "The Atom Gives Up," and this was published in the Saturday Evening Post. And it was, I don't know how it got through. There was no censorship that I know of at that time. It just happened that the writer of the article had submitted it to someone who knew nothing about the innermost secret. The Manhattan Project was top secret, and so the thing was simply published, and that's all there was to it. Well, after the article came out, I suppose the FBI or those in charge stepped in, and they quietly got them out of the library, took as many as they could out of the secondhand magazine market, and they just sort of made the copies disappear as much as possible. Do any of you gentlemen happen to know about that? Well, it is true that there wasn't much they could do. They just had to spirit these articles away. They didn't want to make too much of a fuss about the thing because of the fact that somebody might suspect something. So they had to do it quietly. Then, well, a matter of a few years later, boom, off went the atomic bomb.
And to carry your analogy out to the ultimate, We like to demonstrate the fact that this Earth itself that we're riding on, spinning on its axis and orbiting around the sun, is literally a spacecraft demonstrating everything we're talking about here tonight. It is rotating and orbiting at a certain constant speed in a magnetic field. And it is literally a demonstration of a spacecraft.
Would you say offhand that the Earth was in itself a magnet?
I would say it is.
Mr. Tolkien, would you assume from the measurements you're able to make on Earth that the moon itself has a gravitational field?
Definitely.
And here is your chance for the fact that it has a gravitational field and that it does not work a lot of action.
It does not rotate on its axis.
No, the moon doesn't rotate on its axis. Oh, wait a minute.
Sure it does.
It's axial rotation.
It's equivalent to one rotation is equivalent to one revolution.
Yes. Now, how long does it take?
28 days.
Now, the Earth takes 1 day. We would assume, therefore, that the Earth had 28 times as much power as the moon.
No, I wouldn't assume anything. All I know is that the moon rotates in 28 days, the Earth rotates in 1 day.
We have a proportion law there. Take the center of gravity of the Earth is from the center of the Earth is standing up. And that's why the engineers and scientists have so easily evaluated the velocity of the craft that is hitting the Earth by the orbit of it, predicated upon the pattern that has already been set up by the amount of time it takes the moon to rotate once around the Earth from the center of the Earth's course. This being 28 days and the distance being 240,000 miles, it's so easy to evaluate the velocity of something 500 miles out, something 1,000 miles out, 2,000, until you get up to the moon, which makes it 28 days.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, Mr. Carr, but we're going to have to take care of a little business, and I don't know.